Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Maggs, bringing you 30 minutes packed with the latest South African and global news. We are live right now and then you can catch it later as a podcast. Stay tuned for interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, delivering all the essential updates you need, fast and focused. It's Tuesday, the 3rd of September, coming up on the program. Does Songezo Zibi hold the big new broom that Scopa needs? How and why young working women are buying more houses? The war for talent will put executive pay in the tech space under the spotlight. And can the word Africa be considered a racial slur? A top academic shares his thoughts. It's been about 2 months since Rise Mzansi leader Songezo Zibi took over the reins as the chair of the parliamentary watchdog Scopa, or the Standing Committee on Public Accounts. Now, Scopa, as you know, is a vital parliamentary oversight body responsible for scrutinising the expenditure of public funds by government departments as well as state institutions. It ensures accountability, transparency and proper financial management in the use of taxpayer money. Zibi joins me now for an update and to share his strategy going forward to ensure the optimal use of public funds. So firstly, how tough do you anticipate your role as Scopa chair is going to be, given the entrenched culture of malfeasance in government spending?
It's a very tough job, Jeremy, because of the cultural issues that you talk about, and also because we are going to make it our mission as a committee that we try and effect to help the government or force the government to effect culture change and to also effect systemic changes that lead to better governance and better management of financial resources, all the way up to the appointment of the correct officials for the right role so that they're adequately qualified and experienced. And that there is also accountability where somebody has committed an offense. They're not only disciplined where criminal charges need to take place, they do. And that such people cannot work in the system, elsewhere in the system like they do now.
Let me suggest to you that your biggest difficulty is going to be gaining the cooperation of committee members from diverse political backgrounds. What's the strategy there? How are you going to do that? It's an effort in corralling a lot of different approaches and philosophies.
Yes, Jeremy. In fact, that is where I started. And a lot of people have been asking, when is Scopa going to start showing us some action? And that's because as a leader in such a situation, such as you have in a parliamentary committee, you've got to get the people working as a team. I must say that I've got three things working in our favor. The first is that no political party has a majority now, so nobody is going to be able to bully their way into any position opposing or for. So that's the first thing. So consensus becomes the only way forward. The second thing is that I think everybody understands that we are in a different moment and they want to do a better job than the previous parliament, and we need to take that spirit, bottle it up and continue to sustain it. The third thing is that we have got one returning MP who was in the committee from last year, and she's really strong, from the EFF, Honorable Veronica Mente. And some of the new MPs actually have really useful skills. We've got somebody who's an accountant or two. We've got two accountants. We've got a senior internal auditor. We've got a former head of finance in a municipality and so on. That's really helpful because it means you also have the skills you need. So far, the spirit has been really good, Jeremy. I have to say, I'm quite pleased.
So as I'm listening to you, I'm also thinking that it's not so much about resolving conflict, perhaps, as to finding an inner independent courage.
It's an inner independent courage, but a commonality of purpose, Jeremy, as well. So to reduce it to one sentence, we're going to have as our goal minimizing or eliminating fiscal loss. So that's the first thing. How do we do that? We do that by targeting the most problematic systematic challenges that you've got in the system. So you spoke about the culture, we spoke about governance, we speak about accountability, and so on. We're going to target that firstly. And secondly, we're going to pick our cases really carefully and focus on those so that we can use those case studies to motivate for the systemic changes that we're looking for and mix it up. SOCs, government departments at national level, provincial level, municipalities and municipal agencies over the 5 years. So that's broadly, that's how we're going to go about doing our work.
Have you started identifying those cases yet?
Yes, you know, so we are on an extended induction, I would call it, from since we started about 2-3 weeks ago to the 18th of September. So what we're doing, we're asking all the, I would say, a well-known kind of entities. I don't want to call them problem children, but I think that's the right word, that's the right term, to come and present to the committee. So we've got the National Skills Fund today. We've got NSFAS. We're going to have Transnet. We're going to talk to ESCOM. We're going to talk to PRASA. We're going to talk to all of these entities that everybody knows about. We need the MPs to understand those entities, understand what they work, what their historical challenges are, what their current challenges are, so that when we design an oversight program from October on, it's based on the most up-to-date information. And finally, Jeremy, we are really happy to have the Auditor General briefing us ahead of each of these engagements so that we understand what, from the auditor's perspective, what the issues are independently, and then we can engage with these entities the next day or the following week.
I understand that it's an entirely new entity that you are chairing, but you will also concede that you can't spend too much time learning and doing due diligence. There is an expectation that you get down to work soon and start producing some results.
Yes, that happens from October. So in terms of the government and parliament calendar, all of these entities will come back from October to December to present their annual financial statements, to present their audit reports and so on. And the process we are on now is going to help to lead to more pointed questions at that time. If we don't do this now, we can't ask good questions later on. So the two are linked. There'll be tough questions now, but even tougher when they return in a few weeks' time.
Talking about tough questions, another difficulty I imagine is going to be balancing or finding a balance in holding SOE boards accountable while also maintaining a workable and, I guess, non-adversarial relationship.
Yes. In fact, look, what I've been pleased about, and maybe it's because it's a fresh start, all the entities that we've invited to come to Scopa, they've readily agreed. ESCOM, for instance, have said they would like to talk to us for longer than 3 hours. So if we don't mind coming to their premises, they would host us all day. There are two things that are important, Jeremy. The first is that we do need to make sure that the level of ministerial interference with the boards reduces, because they're also sometimes neutralized by ministerial fiat, because a minister does not like one or other thing after a board has deliberated for a long time. That causes, in turn, the board to interfere with the work of management. So when I spoke about the systemic changes we need to make sure that the roles of the minister are clear, the role of the board is clear, and the role of management is clear. And the accountability of the minister to Scopa and Parliament is making sure that you've got a strong board, capable, experienced chair. And the board's job in turn is to make sure that they oversee the governance and strategy of the SOCs, but leave the management to do their work so that you can have a professional management like any large organization.
How exactly are you going to hold the ministers accountable? Will it be a punitive approach, given that in the past, often they have simply ignored or bypassed the job that Scopa has to do?
So we are working with the presidency to make sure that we align the calendar. So often there is an excuse that the minister has been sent somewhere by the president. We have an undertaking from the presidency that's not going to happen anymore. So when a date has been cleared with the president will keep that minister free on that day to come to parliament. If the minister chooses to absent themselves on that day, knowing that the presidency has given them permission to go to come to parliament, we will then subpoena them.
And I think that's a good place to leave it. Songezo Zibi, chair of the parliamentary watchdog Scopa, thank you very much for joining me today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Attention, all investors and finance enthusiasts. Get ready for the annual Money Summit, Africa's largest and most influential savings and investment event. Join me, Jeremy Maggs, on Tuesday, the 10th of September at the Sandton Convention Center as we connect with over 100 top chief executives and industry leaders across 20 exciting conferences and forums, all in one incredible day. Secure your spot now. Register online at www.moneysummit.co.za for free with the code MONEYWEBGUEST. This is your chance to be part of Africa's premier savings and investment event. Don't miss it.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
New data released by Uber Home Loans reveals that young women between the ages of 26 and 30 now account for around 14% of all applications received from females locally. Now, this certainly does sound like a positive development, so let's unpack it a little further. And with me now, Gavin Lomberg, I beg your pardon, Chief Executive Officer of Uber. And first of all then, what do you believe are the key factors driving this particular increase?
What we're seeing in the market, Jeremy, is especially within this segment, women are prioritizing financial independence as well as wealth creation above things like starting a family and so on and so forth. So, you know, financial independence and wealth creation is certainly at the forefront of their mindset, notwithstanding the economic headwinds that we faced. And that trend has steadily grown over the last 5 years. So on average, women buyers sort of aged between 18 and 36 have constituted, you know, around an incremental 30% growth over the last 5 years, plus minus 7% year on year, as a contribution of first-time home buyers. So you can appreciate that within the current economic context, that's not to be sneezed at. That's quite material and quite significant.
Not at all, Gavin. And what do you think is driving or influencing this development?
Again, I think it's just mindset and wanting to acquire assets a lot earlier in their lives, you know, wealth accrual, and really, you know, opportunity. So there's a direct correlation as well with the exponential growth in sectional title and developments, you know, spawning across the country, predominantly across the three metropoles, the three key metropoles within the Western Cape, KZN and Gauteng. And there are some really good opportunities, you know, that they are recognizing, you know, to invest in. Big chunk of these clients, so around 35% of our first-time home buyer market is made up of this segment, women aged between 18 and 30, and around 15% of them are not necessarily first-time home buyers. So you've got around 30% in the first-time home buyer market, but there's a good 15% of them that are repeat buyers. And again, this is a function of what we see happening in the development market, in the sectional title market, and them seeing value in investing earlier, not just for themselves, but also as an investment opportunity.
Having said that, though, are there potential risks for young women purchasing homes on their own, particularly in the context, as you've referenced, of the current high interest rate environment?
Well, if we, you know, we obviously work quite closely in partnership with our banks, and the impairment rate is not discernibly higher within the segment of customers. So there appears to be a lot of business savviness in terms of managing their money responsibly, their investments responsibly. So there's no discernible indicators to suggest that they are overextending themselves and that their credit impairment rate ratio across the big five banks is any worse than any of the other categories. The fact that they've actually managed to that this market has actually managed to grow and become more relevant in the first time and repeat buyer space, coupled with the imminent rate cut, as well as CPI, by all accounts, sort of stabilizing by a further 25 basis points down towards 5%. If anything, we envisage that trend spurring additional growth and contribution from this segment, and clearly banks see them as good risk customers.
Do you think this increasing financial independence of young female home buyers then, Gavin, is going to have any broader impact on the property market itself?
Look, I think certainly what we see is that they are seen as one of the most attractive segments in the market. And again, we are seeing property developers specifically target their offering and their value proposition to this segment of the market, making it highly highly attractive at attractive price points. What you also see now is that a bigger chunk of this segment starting to play and purchase in the 1.2, 1.5 million rand category, and developers are certainly gearing their offerings to that market, understanding that this is a highly lucrative, stable, good quality risk customer that they can go after. So if anything, we see this perpetuating and the trend increasing rather than diminishing over the next few years.
So you talk about this demographic being a high end value proposition. Is there a different way of marketing to this cohort than perhaps more generally?
I think what we're seeing is again the guys in the property environments, and similarly banks through which these guys bank, are being a lot more proactive in terms of positioning their offerings to this base. There's a lot of play in pre-approval, so getting engaging customers proactively once they hit this life stage, with a view to informing them of what it is they could qualify for should they wish to enter the market. So you're seeing a lot more proactivity from all financial institutions, from developers and the like, engaging these customers almost pre-buying cycle, informing them what they could afford should they wish to enter the market, and in that way plant the seed and enable them to acquire properties in the segment proactively.
Certainly is a fascinating insight. Gavin Lomberg, Chief Executive Officer of Uber Home Loans, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
All right, let me pivot now from property to pay, and South African companies are under increasing pressure to attract and retain top talent in, for example, the technology and AI space if they want to keep the burgeoning tech ecosystem on a par with other territories. This also rings true, I guess, for other sectors and often requires deep pockets as companies vie for the cream of the crop. But a specific focus now on tech, and Dr. Chris Blair is the Chief Executive Officer of 21st Century, one of the continent's bigger business and people solution consultancies. And he said in a recent opinion piece that companies need to consider three things when it comes to executive pay. Well, let's find out what they are. He's with me now. And firstly, Dr. Blair, how competitive is this particular space?
Really, there's been quite a bit of change at executive pay level, but specialist pay as well, which obviously IT and AI is really a burgeoning area. And what has really changed quite dramatically is really work from anywhere. So prior to COVID, people didn't think kind of out of the box, and companies didn't allow you to work in a different region when you weren't actually there. So what's actually happened now is South Africa is the good place to go to get really top skill, but at a kind of half the price, if you can call it that. And the people don't even have to leave South Africa necessarily. So there's war for talent at specialist areas like IT and AI has just become really the forefront. And companies are struggling about what they do about that because they have to compete with, as an example, an American company will approach a South African in the IT space and say, you can stay in South Africa, we'll pay you in dollars and we'll pay you anywhere you like, and that's and we'll pay you perhaps not double but somewhere between the the salary in South Africa and the salary they would get in the US. So they actually save some money by paying a little bit less for a top skill, and that's what companies are struggling with. So, and that also happens at executive level. There needs to be a bit more presence at executive level, but companies are finding South Africa to be the place to go and get talent, and that's really what's happening in that space.
So, Chris, if I'm hearing you correctly, this is almost a no-win situation for South African domiciled companies, given that it's almost impossible to compete with a dollar-based salary.
It is, and there are so many jobs that are portable, or when I say portable, you can do them from anywhere. So those jobs are obviously, South African companies are struggling to attract and retain those people. And they've got a further problem, because if they attract and retain those people in South Africa, there's an inequity within the company. So pay has got an external equity issue and then an internal. So the external one is the United States company competes with South Africa, offers a much better salary in dollars. The internal one is the South African company reacts and says, oh, we really need this person. They're a top programmer, whoever they are. And then they up their pay. But then, as you know, Jeremy, people at different jobs are at different pay grades. And the other jobs at that same grade, and now you're paying that particular job, let's say, a 50% premium. So now there becomes an internal equity issue.
And this could have a real impact. This could have a real impact, Chris, on the future viability of South African domiciled companies if they're going to struggle in this respect. Because if you don't have the right talent, you're not going to survive in a competitive marketplace. So are there strategies they can then adopt to try and counter this?
Yeah, so that's a very good question, Jeremy, because at the end of the day, we say in remuneration that the money that you receive is just a hygiene factor, and you need to have the total employee value proposition, which is all the other elements. But now these companies are basically offering those additional employee benefits like work from anywhere. So as you know, there's been a great resistance for people to go back to the office full time. And the American company says, well, don't worry, we don't even need to see you. You can stay in South Africa. And then so even outside of the money, South African companies are struggling, because now you've got a policy where you say, okay, all of our people who are working in IT can take 5 days, or you know, work from anywhere, but all the other people who are doing other jobs must come into the office. So then there becomes that internal inequity. So it really is a challenge that companies are facing at the moment, and I'm sure over time they will work out ways to combat it. But at the moment, it's basically like a brain drain, but the people aren't even leaving the country.
In the short term, are there any recommendations that you would have for companies to navigate this potential backlash?
Yeah, so I think that perhaps the way that companies could look at it is to say, so if a company is able to be kind of a virtual company, because it's in the digital industry or whatever, then they could actually make that part of their value proposition, so that they remove that element where the person is being offered this job from the UK or from Switzerland or wherever, and they can work from home or work from their holiday home or whatever they want to do. So that would be where the whole industry is able to give that flexibility. And then on top of that, I would say that they could use elements of pay like a share structure within the company where the person becomes an owner, and that might sway it, because the employee says I want to stay in South Africa, I don't want to go overseas, but I've been given this ownership, so yes, I know I could earn more money, but at least I've got the ownership in the company, and it will translate at some point into cash if I sell those shares. So there are ways of doing it without just taking the base salary and ramping it up to try and match the US salary. But that's the challenge that companies have got, and it's becoming very much that they almost have to sit down with the employee and say, what would make you stay here? What would make you stay in, not in South Africa, but stay in this company versus working for a company that is, you know, 12,000 miles away?
Dr. Chris Blair, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you so much for the insight. Chief Executive Officer, 21st Century, I appreciate your time today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
And finally on the program today, have you ever given much thought to the origin of the name Africa? Well, if history books are to be believed, the continent was named by European explorers in the 1300s. The word is believed to have come from the Greek word, which means without cold, and in Latin it translates to Africa, which means sunny. So given its origins, can the name Africa be considered a racial slur? Well, it's a question that's been asked by Professor Jonathan Okeke Chimekonam, who is based at the Department of Philosophy at the University of Pretoria. He's a specialist in African philosophy, race, and colonial studies. And firstly then, why have you raised the issue of changing the name of Africa, and what motivated this exploration?
Okay, thank you very much. More profoundly, we live in a world where racism and the consequences of colonialism, all these things, the Liga, the continent, the Liga people on this continent. And so it becomes something very important that some of these factors are addressed, such as anything that might have a connection with the ongoing, continuing racist problems that continue to affect people psychologically and socially. And we think that the name of the continent could be one of them. So that was really the motivation.
Professor, what specifically then would you find problematic about the name, and how do you believe it's impacted the continent's identity?
Okay, so we delved into history to take a look at various sources of the name Africa. There are sources from within the continent, and there are also sources from outside the continent. But then we found two outstanding sources, two sources from outside the continent to be outstanding and to have more credibility in the resources that we've had to work with. And those are the linguistic roots that traces to the Greek language, okay, in the ancient times, Africa, which means without gold, and the one that traces to the Latin language in ancient Rome, that is Africa, meaning sunny, all right? So it might sound innocuous to name a continent by the climate, as a matter of fact, but when we go down, take a walk down history and see how that has evolved, and on to the modern time of the scientific racism theory and all of that, and the current situation of racism in the world, the anti-African racism and prejudice, then you begin to see these things line up. And if we are fighting racism as we are doing in different parts of the world, making policies and laws in this country, then it becomes imperative that some of its roots are tackled. And this also was also a subject of another research on the politics of color branding as the last frontier of racism. But that's a discussion for another day.
Professor, do you think there are any serious implications then for continuing to use the name, maybe in terms of cultural and historical representation? Or do you think simply the name has become too entrenched, and that there would be very little appetite to even entertain a discussion about a change of name?
There's always a need to rewrite history, twisted negative history that are affecting people. Unfortunately, people might think that this subject, this the name of Africa, well, what difference would it make? It's going to be very difficult to change the name and all that. Wherever that's their will, that's their will, always their way. And if we respect history, if we cherish the identity of the people, if we think that constructing a new future for the continent is something important and viable, then this name change becomes very imperative. Because I tell you what, everyone is aware of the anti-African prejudice and racism all over the world, despite the laws and policies that have been enacted, all right, even parts of the world. This is largely due to the fact that Africans have really not taken control of their own narrative and history. And changing a name is going to send a powerful statement. It's going to create a very powerful impression about this. It's not just about the name of the continent. It's also about the names of certain countries there, the colonial names, all right? Fundamentally, what is wrong with some of these names is that these names make references to climate like Africa, to geography like the name South Africa, all right? Ignoring the rich civilizational accomplishments of the people, ignoring, silencing the cultural heritage of the people, ignoring the identity of the very rich and important and exciting ethnic nationalities that dot this continent, and preferring rather to focus on climate or geography and all that. Let me give you an example with South Africa and with Nigeria. All right? South Africa is named according to geography, South Africa. Mm. It is a sort of crazy impression that nobody, there were no inhabitants in that land before the Nemas arrived, or before the Nemas chose to give it that name. That is wrong. And kids grow up in school learning these things. These things have a lot of psychological implications. Why did Zambia, Zimbabwe, Ghana, Burkina Faso, and the rest of them change their names? It is basically because of this. Ideas rule the world. It's that the psychology of a nation has to be right. The psychology of the people has to be already something important. And it would be terrible for us to continue to treat these sort of serious issues with levity.
So, Professor, my final question then, is there a better name?
Yes. In our research, we proposed Anesia. Anesia is from Igbo African language. It's a language spoken by over 50 million people. And the name Anesia means land of origin. And this has direct connection with something that the continent should be proud of. For example, not so far away from Johannesburg, a site that is now designated UNESCO World Heritage Site was discovered a couple of years ago. And human remains were excavated that dates back to as long as 200,000 years. And there are other conclusions from paleontologists and archaeologists that humanity first lived on this continent. And the first language, you know, was also spoken on this continent. It's been concluded long ago by linguists and all that. So land of origin appropriately designates, you know, something that the continent should be proud of, a story that the continent itself is writing for itself and communicating to the rest of the world that this is how we want to be known. We want that to be a discussion that should be had, not just this continent, by different countries on this continent who still retain their colonial names that may not actually refer to the people or their identity, as the case may be.
Well, it certainly is a fascinating argument and an interesting discussion to have. Professor Chimakonam, thank you very much for talking to me today. And just before I say goodbye, on our online poll today, and this relates to our lead story about the Standing Committee on Public Accounts new chair, Songezo Zibi, I'd like to know if you are confident in his ability, let's wait and see, or too tough a job. If you have a view on that, please go to either our X or LinkedIn page. That's our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.